The series of seminars we're going to have this week, entitled Into the Labyrinth, the Middle East After the Gulf War. I'm David Woodward, my wife Ann Woodward, and we're going to do this together. And I just want to make one opening remark. A week ago Monday, when Gorbachev was taken captive, I threw my notes out. Because if the reactionaries controlled the Soviet Union, then all bets are off, and as far as what's going to happen next in the Middle East. But then on Wednesday, I went looking for my notes again. Gorbachev was back in power, and so to speak. And so things were sort of back to a status quo of the past couple of months. And so fortunately, we didn't throw them out. So here we are. And I'm going to go turn off the TVs while my wife takes on the next.
I think at the breakfast they read a little thing about us, but if any of you happen to miss that, or just to introduce us again. David was born and raised in Iran. His parents were Presbyterian missionaries there for 20 years. When he came back to the States, he finished his graduate degree in Near East Language and Literature. So he has a lot of background and education on the Middle East, as well as speaking both Arabic and Persian. I myself bring a different perspective to the class. I'm a native Seattleite. I was born and raised in Seattle, never lived anywhere until I lived in Kuwait, which was definitely a culture shock. So you too can go live in the Middle East and get to know Middle Eastern people, even if you've never been anywhere besides your hometowns. We both lived in Kuwait for a year. David worked for Kuwait University, and I worked for Kuwait University part-time, and spent a lot of time getting to know Arab families. We wanted to get, we're too big of a group to sort of get individual impressions or ideas, but we wanted to get an idea of how many of you have traveled to the Middle East by show of hands. So a couple of you have been there. And how many of you have read much about the Middle East, either books or newspaper articles, magazine articles? Have all of you gotten a chance to read? I guess when we went to Kuwait, people said, Kuwait? Where's Kuwait? What's Kuwait? You know, now it's people, through the last year, we've gotten a chance through our media to know a little bit more about that.
Then we have some resources here at Holden Village. This was the one that I recommended for the series this week. There's only two left in the bookstore. So it is an excellent resource. So at least you can get the title, A Concise History of the Middle East, by Goldschmidt. It's in its second or third edition now. And as I say, there's two of them left in the bookstore, but perhaps you could put in an order for one. I know in Seattle at the Elliott Bay Bookstore they had a lot of these at one time. And so it's been used at the University of Washington in their Near East History course and in other universities. It's a real solid, readable history. It isn't the kind of thing that'll put you to sleep. The author has kind of a wry sense of humor. He doesn't sort of bow and scrape to the great figures of history, but he's almost humorous at points. But it's really a valuable thing, I believe, to go back to pre-Islamic days and get a sense of the whole scope of Middle Eastern history, because it is very, very difficult to make much sense out of events today without that. There are a couple other books in the bookstore. I'm supposed to kind of give a pitch to get people in there. I didn't ask for them to be put in, but they are good resources. One is Arab and Jew. Let me get the author's name here, Shipler. Another one is Understanding Islam by Lippmann. And a third one is From Beirut to Jerusalem by Friedman. So these are some other resources in the bookstore you could run into and pick up one of those. They deal with different things. Most books, if you go into a bookstore, most books deal with something fairly sensational. Typically, they'll pick a topic that's a media kind of topic, particularly the Arab-Israeli conflict. But the Middle East is, of course, far much more than that. And so to get a real sense of the region, you have to look at something that gives you the bigger picture. And I also had an article. I just ran out. But if those of you who've picked up the article can skim through it and then maybe pass it along to someone else to read, that would be a way to kind of share that resource. And I think most of the people on the front here got a copy. So if you'd like to share that with a friend or something, be a way for everybody. But I will summarize that article this morning so you can all kind of know what's in it. So would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, we're going to be investigating then today some of how we can make sense of what's happened in light of all the current events and factors that from both the inside and the outside that have influenced that. At the same time, because of the theme of the summer here at Holden, we want to affirm that all Middle Eastern people are made in the image of God, and that that we love them, and that we really hope to share our enthusiasm for these people with you, and hope that that's contagious. Should we start with the question? Okay. Well, we want to give you just a couple moments to think, and then we'll have you share responses of what three factors, think of three factors you think might have contributed to the Gulf War. Sort of think about those for a moment, and then we'll write up some. Do we all write in that small space?
Yeah, just a few of the sort of try to group them into a couple of different areas. And I'm going to summarize the question.
Sorry, what?
Do you want to write the question up? The big question.
I'm
sorry. The Arab and the Jewish relationship, not a relationship, but the hatred between the Arabs and the Jews.
Greed.
That's what happens.
Power.
Oil. I'm sorry, I don't write very well on these things.
Territorial expansion.
Encouragement of Saddam.
Didn't the British move out? Within 10, I don't know the time of that, but the British movement out of Kuwait.
Kuwait's independence.
Yeah.
61.
Yeah. Was that long ago?
Yeah. But I imagine they, you know, if Britain had still been there strongly, that wouldn't have happened.
You mean lack of British protection, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They wanted to control their needs.
Pardon me?
They wanted to control their needs. They needed water, they needed
Iraq.
Access to the water, right.
Iraq, yeah.
Control.
Needs. Control access to water.
Are there two questions? Is it
just come up with the basic question?
I was wondering if it sort of is what caused the war or U.S. involvement in the war. Are they sort of two questions, or are they really the same?
I think
question?
U.S. involvement would be part of that, right? Right. Do you have some thoughts
about
U.S. involvement?
Well, I was just going to say sort of American lifestyle.
American lifestyle.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Something about power vacuum in the Middle East.
Power vacuum. Yeah, sort of connected to the British,
right.
Loss of British involvement, maybe. Yeah, power back. Somebody else had a comment.
There's not a tradition of democracy in that area. It's kind of a foreign concept.
lack of democratic institutions? So have we kind of exhausted the...
Also, I think the Arab-Iraqi war set the stage.
Iran-Iraq war maybe coming to conclusion, and then Iraq turned its attention.
Maybe it was a practice.
Oh, Iran-Iraq war was a practice run?
Or in fact, it was allowed to go on and on. Set the stage for continuing that kind of activity.
And tied to that, the fact that the U.S. kind of supported Iraq in a sort of, you know, not outright way, but there was a kind of I don't know what you'd call it, low-level sort of
covert
support, perhaps.
Oh, wait, I say U.S., I say Western world.
Western as well, yes. Interesting. Okay. What's interesting to me, I guess the first thing that pops up is that nobody mentioned that it was a fight for freedom, which was, of course, at least what we heard on the media, that was the reason, at least from our government's point of view. Sort of interesting that that isn't the first thing that pops to your mind. Let me kind of summarize some of the points that I make in this article. It's called The Roots of the Gulf Conflict. And what I try to do in this article, I wrote it in January, before the actual groundwork. What I was trying to do, I wrote this for the Seattle Pacific student newspaper, was to just give people sort of telescope the history a little bit and give people a sense of how things got to this point. I had a long discussion with a friend of mine the other day who was on the Saratoga, and he's in the Navy, and he was trying to pin me down and say, well, now, if we hadn't gone in, what would have happened 10 years down the road if Iraq had nuclear weapons? And, you know, we would have been faced with a terrible dilemma. And so therefore trying to sort of pin me down and saying, you know, we had to do this. And I insisted in my Middle Eastern way of not answering his question directly. I kept saying, well, let's look at, you know, this factor and that factor. And so it was a classic meeting of East and West, really. I'm refusing to follow the line of thought. And that's just the way I think. And I think that's the way Middle Eastern people think, is that their history is palpable to them. Their history is just right there for them. They remember freshly events of 1,500 years ago as if it were yesterday. And so the first thing I wanted to bring up was the nature of Iraq and its people. This is a very critical part of the picture. Iraq is not a nation in the sense of say, the Armenian people, who all have one homogeneous kind of background, same language, same religious beliefs. Iraq, as you know, is made up of three very disparate groups, the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds, who are Sunni as well, but different ethnically. So Iraq has never had a sense of being one nation. They have been forced together by the drawing of political boundaries into a very awkward kind of relationship since World War I. And the only way to rule that country because of this history was by force. And the leader who could not rule with strength was likely to lose his head. And that's what happened before Saddam. So the Iraq of history, also the ancient civilization of Babylonia, had a profound influence on Saddam. His own allusions to being like those great leaders of the past. And we sort of scoff at that. I mean, that seems to us sort of ludicrous that this guy could pose as a great empire builder. But from his own perspective, this is what gave Iraq an identity. In order to try to build a sense of a nation, Saddam felt it necessary to draw on that great history. So that helps us to understand a little bit more. The other important factor there is that Saddam was trying to also liken himself to Nasser, to be the modern day Arab, the great leader of the Middle East. And again, he wasn't really taken seriously until the U.S. opposed him, at which point he suddenly took on a much greater stature, much like Muammar Gaddafi. Until the U.S. opposed Gaddafi, within the Middle East, he was just viewed as a very peripheral figure. But once the great empire opposed him, he became a great figure. So with an oppressed people, the Arab people as a whole view themselves as an oppressed people, anyone who opposes the what they consider the oppressor or the great empire, they then become a hero, regardless of what they're like ethically or morally. You know, any external enemy creates a kind of internal unity in any country. So that's sort of the nature of Iraq and its people that sort of summarizes very, very briefly that point. Any comments on that before I go on? Okay. Second point would be, as has been alluded to, Britain's role in the formation of Kuwait. You know, in the 1700s, Britain was very active in building its empire in India. And so one of their primary goals in the Middle East was to build stations around the peninsula. This was one of them. But they also developed a treaty with some of the rulers of these little princedoms and kingdoms around the boot. And that's why these were called the Trucial States. They had developed a treaty with these various leaders, and this allowed Britain to have control so that these pirate raiders would not raid the British ships. And Britain then could also have some influence on the internal affairs here. And so Kuwait, which became kind of established as a garrison town in the late 1700s, from the beginning was influenced by Britain, and then was established as a protectorate in 1899, and then finally gained its independence in 1961. So Britain really was instrumental in Kuwait's formation. When oil was discovered in Iran around 1900, turn of the century, actually they knew there was oil there a little before, but suddenly Kuwait took on greater prominence. And when Iraq was fully became a nation in around 1920, you know, Iraq was outraged at losing this territory of Kuwait, which had been under their governor of Basra. So they never accepted this until 1963. They finally gave up. But they had believed all along that this was their territory. So that sets the stage for what was going on later. In the Iraqi mindset, they had never given up the idea, really, that Kuwait was part of their territory. In their mind, it was their territory. Just like in Germany and France, Alsace-Lorraine has been fought over for decades and decades, and up until World War II. And probably in the minds of some, still is a point of contention between Iraq and, Germany and France. Mm-hmm.
When you were speaking of Iraq, never giving up the idea of Kuwait,
mm-hmm.
And he was saying that as a child in school, they were taught to, when they drew the border, put dotted lines where Kuwait was.
Mm.
So even if you have children.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and from their perspective, it was only in World War I that lines were drawn in the Middle East. There were no geographical lines written anywhere for this region until that time. So the whole concept that we have in the West of drawing a boundary and protecting it as a boundary, a specific cartographic line, was foreign to them. Instead, for thousands of years, they had a kind of rule by geographic high points, you know, rivers, mountains, ranges, whatever a certain king could protect was his territory. And this was very fluid. And for centuries, you know, the power center in Iraq would fight with the power center in Iran, and the lines would move constantly. So the idea of a fixed for all time boundary was a new invention for the Middle East.
When you said that Iraq was a protectorate of Britain in
Kuwait, 1899. Iraq didn't exist as a nation until 1920.
Didn't we know it all as Arabia?
Well, Arabia would have defined only the peninsula.
That's right.
And up into Syria, greater Syria, yeah. But Iran was always distinct.
Yeah, we knew that as Persia.
Persia, right. And Egypt was Egypt. You know, Egypt really is distinct from Arabia, even though they speak Arabic in Egypt. Yeah. Any other quick questions, things that come
to mind? The geographical boundaries of Kuwait, is there any ethnic relationships between the Kuwaitis and the Iraqis? Are they from similar...
Yeah, I mean, if you take away all the boundary lines, then suddenly you realize, well, gee, they are all kind of the same, you know, from the same area. And while there are all kinds of overlayers of ethnic differences, you can see how family relationships would extend, you know, throughout the region. So you have people who are Iranian, Persian speaking, but yet some of them have Arab background, and Arabs who have Persian background, and vice versa. You know, it just, this kind of overlaying goes throughout the region. So this modern idea of a boundary and a nation state is really in direct conflict with the idea of an Arab people, an Arab nation. So for Arab people, this is why World War I is such a watershed, because it means this was the breakup of this dream of an Arab nation. Now, before World War I, there wasn't an Arab nation. There was an Ottoman Empire, and the Arab people were subject to the Ottomans. But in their mind, the great empire, the early Islamic Empire, which was operated, run by Arabs, was this golden era that they all remember fresh. It's fresh in their mind. You know, that is what Arabs were meant to be. You know, a great, you know, nation of Arab people. And they longed for that. But I think finally after the Gulf War, this was sort of the death knell, really, of the dream of an Arab state. I'd say Arabs today, as opposed to a year ago, are finally convinced that Arab nationalism is dead, basically. And they've all given in to a kind of a way of thinking of, well, you have to go with the flow. We have to survive. We have to get with it economically and politically. I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just what I sense with the Gulf War was a real finality to the whole idea that, gee, we could all get together someday. Yeah.
Why does it seem that there is that lack of cooperation or unity sometimes between Arab nations, and they don't present the United Front?
Well, as I said, there hasn't been an Arab nation since about 700 AD. Yeah, there has usually been a superior force, such as the Ottoman Empire or the Persian Empire or European Empire, that has really prevented that. There's been no way. They've always been at the crossroads. I mean, if you just look at the Middle East on a world map, what stands out is that it's a crossroads. And so any great nation was eventually would have to succumb to some other power coming through. You know, it's like a train junction, you know, and all these, the Mongols come ramming through into Egypt, or, you know, it was very tough to guard the territorial integrity.
When we speak of Arabs or Arab nation, we're talking geographic, we're talking ethnic, what?
That's an excellent question. I mean, this is why I put the terms up here. You have Islam, Muslim, Coptic, Orthodox, Arab, Iranian, Jew, etc., meaning there are many other such ethnic linguistic groups. Sunni, Shia, which are the two main Islamic groups under Muslim Islam, And then the geographic term, Middle East, Near East. And I could spend an hour on any one of those terms, if you'd like. But the biggest thing is to understand that when I focus on Arab, because that is the bulk of the population of the Middle East, Arabic meaning Arabic speaking Arabic, and also a sense of an Arab culture. But you know, when you get into North Africa, where they speak Arabic, it becomes an amalgam of Arab and North African. North African has its own kind of culture, mixing in with you know, ancient Christian civilization, Berber civilization, and Africanness that's different. Turkey is totally non-Arab, although they used the Arabic script until Ataturk introduced the European script. But Turkey is totally non-Arab. Iran is virtually totally non-Arab. It has an Arabic minority. But Iran, I mean, Iranians despise Arabs in many cases, and they would have nothing to do with them. I mean, Iranians resent the Arabs for coming in and dominating in the 7th and 8th century, and they still haven't forgiven them. So it's fresh in their minds. I mean, when you think of history, we think of, you know, 200 years seems a long time, but for them, that's just a real small part of their sense of what is their history. Any other general? Okay, let me run on to the next couple points. Yeah, we're almost over, right? Okay. Okay, let's see. I talked a little bit about Britain's role in the formation of Kuwait. Britain, you know, I won't use the term villain, but Britain really did some interesting manipulation of this region and has, you know, has played such a key role that just studying Britain's role in Middle East history will help you to understand a lot about what's been happening in the region. Let's see, the third point would be Arab-Israeli conflict and Arab nationalism. We've touched on that as a very important factor in the Gulf War. Oil, of course. And fifth, the U.S. replacing Britain as the dominant force in the region. And those are points that you all brought up. So I'll stop there, and if there are any general questions that want to be brought up, take a couple more, and then we'll move on to kind of current events and where we're going. Do you want to, any other comments or in general about the war and why we had the war? And
or about the people,
the
too,
people.
If you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, you could also just ask us about Kuwait. We did live there for a year. And
we've had contacts with people who were there through the war.
Do the people of Kuwait feel like they're part of Iraq?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, when we lived in Kuwait, the sort of standing joke, I guess if you could call it, was as long as Iraq is busy fighting Iran, we were safe, because they were too busy up there, and that Kuwait would be safe. But the inevitability of Iraq coming in, they had come in previously, I think in the early 60s or...
Early 70s, 73.
Early 70s. Had
and
come
before that,
in
right.
Across the border, and the British had forced them back. And that was just the end of several times when they tried to come in. Boubian Island, which... Well, I don't know if you all can see it, but if you come up here, you can see, and it was in the news too, there's an island, a big island right off Kuwait's coast that's between the two, and it's got green around it, so it's officially Kuwait, I guess. But Boubian Island was a very sore point too, because Iraq wanted it, and Kuwait had it. Kuwait built a bridge out to this island. There's nothing on the island. Half of it goes underwater when the tide comes in. So you can't really build anything on this island. But Kuwait built a bridge out to it as a statement. So the Kuwaitis weren't interested in being taken over. They, rumor has it, who knows, but that Kuwait government paid millions of dollars to the Iraq government sort of as a loan for the war, but in some ways as a way of keeping them from invading Kuwait.
It seems a question in my mind is just who is a Kuwaiti, because we hear so much about
the Palestinians being in there, of course, imported laborers from all over the Middle East and the Far East. And it seems to me that when I try to identify a Kuwaiti, I would have an extremely difficult thing, the picture I see.
Who have been there for hundreds of years, and they're quite a large family too, you know, between cousins and aunts and uncles and relatives and so on, they're a big family. Then there are people that are living in the region, the Kuwaiti family that we spent a lot of time with, the husbands, relatives were from Saudi Arabia, from the peninsula area, and came in or sort of lived there when the lines were drawn. And the mother of this family, however, was Palestinian, but she happened to live there before 1950s, in the 50s, when in the 1950s at one point they made those people Kuwaiti. But you can't become a Kuwaiti citizen unless you're born a Kuwaiti citizen. And there are a large number of expats in the country, which consist of the Palestinians. There were a large number of Iraqis, a large number of Indians, other Europeans, Japanese. So more than half the population at the time we lived there was expatriate, which was a concern, I think. We lived, as a matter of fact, during the war, when all the Americans were finally released, or all the Westerners were finally released in December, they had a couple of people saying how they had housed some of these Westerners to keep them safe and where they had moved them. I don't know if any of you saw those news articles, but so I was watching the map desperately to find out where they had moved these people to, and they said the most dangerous neighborhood, and they circled it, happened to have been our neighborhood. And I said to Dave, why was our neighborhood so dangerous? We had a lot of Iraqi neighbors, and their concern at that time was which Iraqi is going to be pro-Kuwaiti and which Iraqi is going to support the invading forces. But the Kuwaitis themselves are most, well, and then there's also a lot of Iranian families who have been in Kuwait for a couple of hundred years, who consider themselves Kuwaiti but are still Persian-speaking and Arabic-speaking and English-speaking. But
there was a fishing village there before oil was discovered. And so basically there was a ruling family, there was a small village. It might have had one road down the middle of the village that went half a mile or something. And they lived on pearl diving, fishing, and they had to import water from Iran. They had to bring water from the Tigris and Euphrates by boat to Kuwait, because there's no water source there. And then there was some minor trade that went from Kuwait into the interior. So those who are ethnically Kuwaiti, so to speak, are a combination of these village people and desert people that came in, like Saudi tribes, very much like those people. And then those who were able to come in and immigrate as oil was discovered and start working in the fields and get into business there before they sort of shut the door. And so
That makes it harder to define a personal freedom is why the war was fought. It was more a freedom of economic values.
Right. Well, to be fair to the, say, the people in the UN or the US government or whatever, I mean, there is a certain principle in the modern day, which is that now we've accepted the idea of geographic boundaries and we have to abide by this, or else all the other little countries in Africa and elsewhere are liable to be overrun by their stronger neighbor. That seems to be part of the principle there. And I don't really have a good answer for that. I mean, you know, Africa to this day is suffering from, you know, this whole dilemma.
Well, we suffer right here in the United States from that, because we have ethnic groups that are now considering the thought that they want to free this part of the country or that part of the country, because that is ours. And I see not a great deal of difference between that and what's going on over in the Middle East.
Ultimately the solution is that stronger neighbors won't want to overrun their neighbors. I mean, you know, if we could end up with a situation as is happening in the Soviet Union, where they can end up with kind of an understanding between various groups and get away from the politics of the guy with the bigger bat, you know, then hopefully you can end up with get moving away from that approach.
They're religious ethnic. Do they have a big dream of peace someday, or are they interested in hanging on to all those other feelings?
That's a very good question. Islam, and I'll get into that on Wednesday a little bit, looking at Islamic reform movement. Tomorrow we'll talk a little bit about the region, its people, the different cultural groups there. But yes, in Islam there is the idea of a brotherhood. They don't talk a lot about a sisterhood, but we can talk about that too. But no, they have the sense of within Islam there is peace, there should be peace. And so this was one of the real traumas of this war, was that an Arab brother, so to speak, had attacked another Arab brother, and that this is such a creates such anxieties and tension within them. You know, this should not happen. Muslim should not attack Muslim. Now, between Iran and Iraq, one was Shia, one was Sunni, so it was still very painful, but not quite as painful as one Sunni country attacking another Sunni country. But yes, they have a vision that someday there will be a Pax Islamica, but they don't really have a sense of, there isn't an Islamic teaching that the whole world will be at peace in a sort of interreligious Unitarian kind of thing. That is not really Islamic at all. Now, the caveat there is that within Islam is Sufism, mysticism, and the mystics are entirely different. The Sufis incorporate Christian concepts, Hindu concepts. They incorporate all different ideas in their thinking, and very, very different from the traditional Orthodox Islamic teaching. And by the way, the average Muslim that you might run into, the most common comment they will make is, well, there are many roads to God, you know, and as long as you believe in God, you know, you're okay. The only problem is that does leave out the Buddhists and those who don't believe in a theistic God. But as long as you believe in a theistic conception of God, they sort of accept that. They are, in fact, Islam historically was very tolerant of, say, the Jews. Does that sort of shock you? Historically, Jews were, at many times in points in history, were likely to leave areas in Christendom to live in areas under Islam, because the Islamic Empire was more tolerant. And within the European Christendom, the Jews were persecuted more severely, which is sort of not what we think of today. We think of Europe as being very tolerant, and so on. Most of European history, the Jews were severely persecuted.
You know, speaking of the area of boundaries in relationship to the war, if you look at Israel and what was happening there with the Palestinian state issue, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank issue become much more on the front burner. So the boundaries really went far beyond where that war is and what was happening there. You saw a lot more violence in that region of the world, that area of people. I think the media did a great disservice to the Kurds. It showed them throwing a bunch of food out to them, and 2 weeks later you never heard another word about it. Mm-hmm. Well, they still must be suffering. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at how the media handle it, a lot of people think they gave fair coverage of the war. I personally don't think they did, if you really start to study the tapes. But the boundaries is really an issue that goes well beyond where that war is, but it's hard to say how the boys think about it, you know, when they sit around the table and the State Department experts and what their interpretation of it is. But I think the key word up there, as I see it, is greed, because if they didn't have those billions of barrels of oil sitting in reserve, I'm not sure we would have been there.
Yeah, and I think another element that's a little more subtle, and I agree, I think to a large degree, that it's economic, but also there's let's call it not racism, but cultural difference and real stereotyping and prejudicial feeling between Middle Eastern people and Western people. And this goes back to the Crusades, and if not before, they're just, one way I put it is this, can anyone recall a movie where you saw an Arab family, a scene of an Arab family having a normal mealtime or just kind of pleasantly interacting? Can you recall a movie where you've seen a scene of that? I can't think of a single film. Arabs are invariably depicted as political figures or, you know, in sort of a them, not necessarily always bad, but they're always outside the home. They're maybe a colleague at best, but you don't see the sort of what bonds Arabs together, the humanness, the human face, the sense that these are people that can be loving. And so it's much easier to oppose them or to attack. I mean, if and this is, I think, what happened in Europe, what the Nazis tried to do to the Jews, to create an image of these people as vermin, as something that should be eradicated. And that's the great danger, I think, of stereotyping, of lumping people into a group. And I think that made it a lot easier to go into this conflict. If the Iraqis were British, you know, if they looked like us and talked like us, it would be much more painful to go into a conflict. And so this is something I maintain is really an important part of the picture, and something that we want to try to address is helping build a sense of empathy and understanding and a feeling of, gee, we have something in common.
Yeah, along that line, the presentation of the media of Iraq during the war and its modern cities, it's people that look and dress a lot like us. It wasn't a shock to me, mm-hmm. but you know, I had always pictured those people as being nomadic, mm-hmm. In nature, mm-hmm. and to see that yes, they live in structures like we do. They have a way of life, mm-hmm. family life, just like that. I think probably news presentations have provided more of that than any other type of media presentation we have. Mm-hmm. But it was something that I didn't deny, but which I can't say did not surprise me when I saw some of these mm-hmm. presentations.
Did you?
Keeper of the time, you said.
Oh, very good, yes. Keeping us on schedule. We should probably move on to the next slide. That whole thing, I would really encourage you this today to maybe discuss that whole idea of the issue of how we view Middle Eastern people and how we can maybe deal with that, you know, to get a sense of, gee, they might be like us, and how to develop that sense of...
Recently, that movie Not Without My Daughter really put us back some generations. That one in the Jerry Levin story, I don't know if you saw that one on TV, mm-hmm. about when he was taken. I mean, both of them true stories. But then there's also, you know, sort of your ma and pa in Iraq. I mean, you know, they don't show those kinds of family life things. And so we do get the sensational. We do get the...
Well, how do the Kuwaitis feel about us? I mean, from that, I heard the woman who wrote Not Without My Daughter at a lecture series in our hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, and I also read the book, and they were taught, those kids were taught in school not to like the Americans. So I was wondering how the Kuwaitis feel about us coming in there and then helping them and then all of a sudden leaving them, and they still have a lot to contend with, you know. How do they feel about that?
since the war, I couldn't speak, you know, but at least the ones that we've talked to have been very, I mean, they like Americans. I mean, I was so surprised because of our government policies in the Middle East, thinking, oh no, you know, I have to watch myself and they're not going to like me. And, you know, every so often we get these warnings, we weren't supposed to leave our apartment for a variety of reasons, but it was almost embarrassing because they were so warm and friendly, and we love America. And because one of the things I think that's very different in their mindset is because their government doesn't represent them, they don't feel like our government is what we are. Do you know what I mean? In other words, I mean, we actually do elect our government,
right,
and they are more representative of us. They don't elect their government. So that because they don't feel like their government represents them, they don't hold us responsible for what our government does. And, but they like us as a people. And they were always very warm and friendly. And right after the, if you remember the massacre in the...
Shatila.
In the Palestinian refugee camps, we were in Kuwait at the time, and we were riding with a taxi driver somewhere, and he was Palestinian, and he was going on about the mothers and the sisters that were murdered and slaughtered and so on. He's driving, of course, madly down the road. But, you know, part of it is some...
He's with his hands going...
And he knew we were Americans, and it's part of our policy that's caused what's all going on there. And yet he had no... I mean, he wasn't angry with us at all. He was very angry with our government. And the policies there, but they never held us responsible for what our government did. They were always very warm and friendly towards American people. Now, because we've gone in and helped the Kuwaitis and left, I'm not sure that, I mean, they're hiring American companies to come back and do. Kuwait doesn't really need charity, you know.
Another thing I should mention is Not Without My Daughter, I believe, takes place in Iran.
Yeah. Right.
And Iran, of course, is a whole other story, but ironically, a doctor from our church, University Presbyterian Church in Seattle, went into Iran this spring. He went with a medical team from Holland and was the chief medical doctor in the team, and he was amazed. Over all the hotel entrances was "Down with America," but all the Iranians he met just were real wonderful to him. You know, they just, you know,
death
he got,
to America.
Yeah, they always said "Death to America," "Down with America." But all the people he met just thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, they just, it's wonderful. We love to have relations with America again. And, you know, Iranians really are anxious to reestablish relations with the U.S.
Do you think maybe our perception from the States is more from what the media portrays and, like, the more militant Islamic jihad?
Oh, it's a joke. I mean, you know, all through the Khomeini years, the insiders knew that these demonstrations were almost professional demonstrators. Mm-hmm. Anytime they'd see a camera, you know, they all come streaming out and start chanting, you know, and then the camera shuts off and they go, you know. So, so, you know, it really was a media image built up. I mean, I know hundreds of Iranians in the U.S., and many of them go back and forth, and they have for the past decade. And basically, the basic sort of attitude in Iran has always been, well, you know, these Muslim clerics, you know, religious people can't run a government efficiently, and they want to get rid of these guys, but they have too much power right now. But the average Iranian just wants to get on with his life, you know. So we can get on into that a little bit more in the coming days. Let me just quickly summarize what the latest events are. I think what some of the latest events might mean in terms of Soviet Union. I don't know, any of you listening to shortwave last couple of days? I have a shortwave radio I brought with me. And
we had to keep you current on any Middle Eastern.
This morning, Gorbachev announced that all republics are free to be independent, and they can elect their own. Yeah.
Yes.
And so... And once they've elected their own leaders, they can decide if they want to be part of the Soviet Union.
So they're disbanding the parliament.
Disbanding the parliament, and so the implication.
And a free election for president of whatever's left of the Soviet Union.
And that Baltic states too?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, everybody.
Crashing down.
Yeah. So the implications for the Middle East are that the way I look at it, there has never been an empire greater than the United States today. I mean, this U.S. government is in such a powerful position. I mean, there's nothing to rival this in history. I mean, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Persian Empire had nothing on this government. And so we just have to pray that we that the American people will help guide this government to use this influence power wisely, because there's really no one now to oppose the U.S. in any effective way, and the third world countries know this. When we went into the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries were not that worried about Saddam. They were worried about the U.S. They admire the U.S., but they fear the U.S. And so this is really, in my mind, the most salient fact today. And it has, you know, you have.
Well, I've been here a week, so I don't know anything about what happened in Russia. I know very little. Do you think the power of the United States had anything to do with what eventually happened in Russia? I mean, I don't know, because I don't know a lot about what's going on here.
Wow, that's as far as whether we sort of helped cause it there, I don't think so.
But resolve it.
Had any.
I think some public figures on TV last week indicated that statements Bush made contributed to the coup makers giving up, but I don't know whether that's true. I doubt it. I sense that it was a desperate move, that they just, you know, had no support from anybody, and it just shows that basically those who said the system was falling apart were right. And the Soviet analysts themselves the last few months were saying that Gorbachev was a transitional figure. He was on his way out. He was unimportant from their point of view. That Yeltsin is the man of the day, and that he is. I mean, he controls now, as president of Russia, something like 70 to 80% of the Soviet Union's resources.
Plus the Russian army is made up of Armenians, Georgians, whatever, they're forced into the army and they hate it.
Right.
So that's one of the most dreaded things.
That's right. Yeah, very, very miserable people.
No support from the army except for the leader.
Right.
In reply to this lady's question here, I think I've heard a lot, there's a lot of groups, both businesses and Christian groups and stuff, that are going over to Russia and introducing all of these people to American ways and democracy, and it's kind of like now that the spark is taken hold, it was just going to overwhelm, you know, the region like a wild. And what I'd say now in the last week, much like a wildfire, there's just no stopping it.
There'll be a McDonald's in every corner.
Oh, joy.
Coke for everyone and jeans, yeah.
I work for a French government, and the Russian city government people for the past 2 years have been coming in, and they want to model how we do things. It's amazing. They just come in and pick your brain. How do you do this? How do you do that? How do you make these decisions? It's phenomenal, right? And they really look up to us as a way, maybe not the way to do things, but they're very interested in changing their system to make it work. They invite us back to help them and so forth. So it's phenomenal, the exchange of information, how hungry they are to get information.
Yeah, I think we live in the most dynamic time in history, frankly. I'm a student of history, and I just cannot think of another era where things happen faster, more dynamically, and where it wasn't all precipitating toward war. You know, I mean, there have been other dramatic periods of history where, you know, there was war on the footing, but this is a very unusual time in my mind. It's a fascinating time, and it's very, very exciting. I do want to say a thing about the Middle East here. I think what will happen in terms of the Middle East is the Islamic republics of the Soviet Union will become sort of allied with Islamic republics, countries of the Middle East to some degree, but they're not that significant politically. They aren't powerful republics. They don't have a lot, but that's going to shift. Iran, therefore, will breathe easily. They have been afraid of Russia since Russia invaded Iran and tried to take over the top half of the country, turn of the century. Iran is really serious about establishing relations with the U.S., and just the last month and a half, we've seen some interesting things in that regard. And let's see, former client states are not receiving any aid. They're going to just be left out there. Yemen, South Yemen, of course, is no longer. It's unified with North Yemen. I don't know if you were aware of that, but about a year and a half ago, the Yemens were unified. And South Yemen had been Marxist, so that's more or less gone. However, Yemen was supportive of Iraq, and it's a kind of a, we're not sure which way Yemen's going in terms of being somewhat antagonistic to the U.S. or what. But Yemen is an interesting country. It represents a real Arab view, whereas a country like Jordan, ironically, is not that central. You know, during the Gulf War, most of the news footage was from Jordan, right? Most of the interesting news was from Amman. And frankly, I mean, Jordan doesn't really represent the thinking of most Arab people. It's primarily represents Palestinian Arab people. And the majority of Arabs are in Egypt, about 50 million in Egypt. And Yemen, about 17 million. And Syria, about 9 million. And Iraq, about 15 million. So that's where the Arab populations really are. And the media didn't really do a very good job of giving us a sense of what's going on in the big Arab world.
Point out where Yemen
Arab
is, I've lost that.
Yemen is down here. And this was southern Yemen. But now it's all one. And all these little lines are dotted. They're undefined boundaries, I guess. Although you just said what Oman, this one has now defined.
Oman and Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And of course, either our news came from Saudi Arabia or Jordan. But, you know, in the Middle East, while Saudi Arabia has a lot of wealth, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a lot of respect within the Middle East as far as being a great Arab leader. And so the great Arab powers are Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Finally, I consider that sort of in a general sense, along with Iran coming out of the war looking great. I mean, they got all those airplanes. I saw those going over and I thought, you know, those Iranians, they're good businessmen. And, you know, they must have struck a deal beforehand, but they were not giving those planes back. I mean, it was just funny almost, but they, you know, they got some war reparations out of that. And now they look very good. Iran has tremendous oil reserves, and once it reestablishes relations outside, it's going to be in strong condition. Turkey has 50 million people, is a very important player in the region, and Egypt, and then Saudi Arabia. And this forms a kind of quadrangle of moderate, so to speak, countries. I mean, Iran is really not as radical as we make it out to be. They want stability. They want economic development, too. And so we're going to end up with this kind of a moderate quadrangle, I think.
What about Syria?
Yeah. No, I just don't consider Syria that significant. We hear a lot about Syria. It's very important. It's integral to having a peaceful settlement here. But within the bigger picture of the Middle East and the next century, Syria is peripheral, really, to the power, you know, where the power is. Syria economically has very little to offer except people in terms of, you know, economic base, and it's a poor country. But it's a very interesting place. I was in Damascus 2 years ago. 2 years ago I took a business trip and went to Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Oman, Jordan, and Damascus. And so maybe later this week I can talk a little bit about that and some of the things that I saw. Syria is very interesting. It's very Mediterranean. You see men and women walking hand in hand. It's like Italy or something. Except that there's guards on every corner.
With machine guns.
You really can't say Hafez Assad is a popular leader. He's, you know, he's a strong man, you know. But if we consider Iraq to be this great enemy of freedom, Assad is no saint either. He eliminated an entire village at one point that opposed him. I mean, they bulldozed the whole village and virtually decimated the population. So that's his style.